Chapter 9. Three's Not Company, Three Ruins Everything. When a man or a woman asks me to help them quit drinking, and I do so, watching as the light slowly comes back into their eyes, that's all God to me. And even though I have a relationship with God, and I'm so often grateful despite everything, I sometimes do want to tell God to go fuck himself for making my road so hard. When I'm clean and sober, it is as if a light has been shown to me, one that I can share with a desperate man who needs help with stopping drinking. It's the same light that hits the ocean in a bright sunlight, the beautiful gold water glistening. That's what God is to me. It also works at night when the moonlight hits the water. Boom! It almost knocks me over, because that 5-year-old boy flying across the continent alone, seeing the city lights of Los Angeles, and he knows he's about to be parented. Well, it's all the same. Why is it so hard for me to stay sober when I see my fellows seemingly doing it easily? Why has my road been so racked with difficulty? Why have I wrestled so hard with life? Why has reality been an acquired taste, and why has it been so hard for me to acquire it? But when I help that one man get sober, or even help thousands get sober in a weekend or a retreat or a conference, all these questions get washed away. It's like I'm standing under a Hawaiian waterfall getting drenched by the beautiful warm water. That's where God is. You're just going to have to trust me on that. I am no saint. None of us are. But once you've been at death's door and you don't die, you would think you'd be bathed in relief and gratitude. But that isn't it at all. Instead, you look at the difficult road ahead of you to get better, and you are pissed. Something else happens, too. You are plagued by this nagging question. Why have I been spared? The other 4 people on the ECMO machine were still dead. There had to be a reason. Part of the answer for me was my 10,000 hours of experience in AA and helping people get sober. That lights me up. Loans me, in fact, a little bit of that golden light from my kitchen. But there has to be more, God. Why did you spare me? I'm ready. Give me the direction and I will follow it. When Woody Allen asked this very question to an alien in the movie Stardust Memories, the alien responds, "Tell funnier jokes." But that can't be it. Either way, I'm ready. And I seek the answer every day. I am a seeker. I seek God. My love life, however, is a different story. I had made more mistakes in my love life than Elizabeth Taylor. I'm a romantic, passionate person. I've longed for love. It's a yearning in me that I cannot fully explain. Once I reached my 40s, the rules had changed. I had done all the sleeping with people I'd ever need to do. I was looking for a partner now, a teammate, someone to share my life with. Also, I have always loved kids. I think it's because I was 10 years old when my sister Caitlin was born. Then came Emily, then Will, and then finally Madeline. I loved playing with them, babysitting them, playing dumb games with them. There is no greater sound on the face of the planet than a child's laughter. So, by the time my 40s were in full swing, I truly wanted a girlfriend, someone I could count on, and who, in turn, could count on me. One night, some friends and I were out celebrating that yet again I had achieved a year of sobriety. My still good friend, David Pressman, introduced me to his girlfriend's sister, Laura. We'd all gone to a Dodgers game together, but for me there was no game, no stadium, no hot dog vendors. Instead, the world had receded to a beautiful face under a baseball cap. I tried to pull out the old Perry charm, anything to make her notice me, but she was too busy parading her glorious personality and wit to others. She was unimpressed that I'd been Chandler. And though she was perfectly pleasant to me, I sensed there was no there for her. As I drove home that night, I gave myself a speech. "Yes, you're disappointed, but not every girl is not going to like you, Maddie." I let it go, but I didn't forget her. Surely our paths would cross again. And they did. This time, the group had decided to play ping pong at the Standard Hotel in downtown L.A. Now, I am no Forrest Gump, but I knew my way around a ping pong table. In fact, if you've seen the finale of season 9 of Friends, you'll know that I'm at least good enough to beat Paul Rudd. I had heard that Laura might make an appearance, so I played ping pong with one eye on the door. And there she was, finally. It was as if she had been hurled into the club by a tornado. She was all energy and jokes. "Everyone in here should kill themselves," Laura said, and boom, like a brick of interest slamming into my face. But this time, I was ready. So began a night that resembled a knife fight, only with jokes. It turned out that the new object of my affection was a stand-up comedian and a successful writer in TV. It was clear from the get-go that we would never run out of things to say to each other. Our first date was on New Year's Eve. A friend was holding a pajama party, and I invited Laura to go with me. After that, our relationship developed slowly. She was careful, and I was willing to do whatever it took, but our affections deepened. It was all good. But nothing is all good in my world. Remember? Enter Rome. I was 2 years sober and thriving in AA, healthy, sponsoring people, writing a TV show. I was happy, even pretty muscular, dare I say. I've been hitting the gym and everything. I was asked to share my story at an AA meeting in West Hollywood, and you're not allowed to say no to an AA request. The room was packed, standing room only. I think word had gotten out that I was speaking. My story at the time had not reached the depths of the last few years. So, as well as detailing everything I'd gone through, I was able to get my share of laughs. At one point, I looked over to the kitchen area and noticed a woman pop her head through the window hatchy thing, leaning on her elbows to prop herself up. She resembled a gorgeous porcelain doll and was staggeringly beautiful. All of a sudden, there were only two people in the room. My AA share became directed only at Rome. It ended up being one of the greatest shares I'd ever given, because this epic beauty was so captivating and I wanted her to know everything about me. I wanted her to know everything. Afterwards, as we gathered outside for a cigarette, we started talking and flirting. "So, what are you up to right now?" she said. "I'm going home to write. All of a sudden, I become a writer," I said. "Well," Rome said, "I make an excellent muse." "I'll bet you do," I said, and then turned and walked away, completely bowled over by this mysterious person. On the way home, I gave myself a talking to. "But what about Laura?" "Yes, of course, wonderful Laura, who I'm falling for more and more each day. But now there's Rome. What's a fella to do? Forget about Rome and continue investigating this Laura thing that is going so well, right? That's what a normal person does under these circumstances." But Rome had cast a spell on me. Despite my positive self-talk, this was when I made a crucial killing mistake. I didn't know it was a mistake at the time. Do any of us know that we are making mistakes while we are making them? If we did, perhaps we wouldn't make them. The mistake was this, and it was a doozy. I began dating both women. This is not a move I recommend under any circumstances, but especially if you are me. I told myself that because I hadn't told either Laura or Rome that we were in a relationship, I was not being an asshole. But there was a little piece of me that knew I was doing something untoward because I cared about both of them. And despite outward appearances, I genuinely didn't want anyone to get hurt, including me. So, Laura and I would go to Kings games together, laugh, and have a wonderful time, though somewhat chaste. The courtship with both women went slowly, but eventually both removed their sex embargoes, and I was now fully involved with two different women at the same time. It was amazing and completely baffling and crazy-making. Did I mention that I had fallen madly in love with both of them? I didn't think it was even possible to do that. I even went online, read a few articles, and learned that this was something that did indeed happen. The feelings I had for both of these women were real, according to what I read. Then Laura and I pronounced ourselves boyfriend and girlfriend. Rome and I not so much, but I was still in trouble. What was I going to do? I enjoyed my time with both of them equally. I loved them. This went on for about 6 months before I came to my senses and decided I had to pick one. I had to stop this nonsense and pick one. Rome was passionate, erotic, funny, smart, but she also seemed to have this fascination with death that confused me. Laura talked about movies and lighter things. There was a sense of being home with her that I had not felt with Rome. I chose Laura. I made the very difficult call to Rome. At first, she was chill about it, until she wasn't. Subsequently, screaming at me for 2 hours in the parking lot of Barney's Beanery on Santa Monica Boulevard when I tried to make amends. You would be hard-pressed to find an angrier person than she was with me that day. But by now, you know me. You know I can't do with getting closer and closer to someone. And that was what was happening with Laura. The fear was burrowing into me. To break up with Laura would be insane. She had it all. We had it all. We were each other's best friend. But the intimacy was scaring me. I knew once again that if she got to know me any better, she would see what I already believed about myself. As ever, I wasn't enough. I didn't matter. Soon she would see this for herself, and she would leave me, and that would annihilate me, and I would never recover. There was another option. I could remain in the relationship, but turn back to drugs and try to maintain a low habit. This would protect me from the fear, allow me to drop my walls, and become even more intimate with her. Turning to drugs has led to nothing but chaos for me, and yet, inconceivably, I chose to do it one more time to deal with the Laura situation. I started taking one pill a day just in order to stay in the relationship. It worked out great at first, but as is the way with drugs, they always win. 6 months later, we had a shitstorm on our hands. I was a mess. Laura broke up with me. I had to go back on Suboxone once again and check into a sober living house. I was afraid I was going to die yet again. Rome was still yelling at me every chance she had, and Laura was hurt and worried. Oh, and gone. Oh, there was something else the magazine said about being in love with two women at the same time. It always had the same ending. You lose them both. So, there I was, living in a Malibu sober living house on 8 milligrams of Suboxone. Though it's a solid detox drug, the best, as I've said over and over, it's the hardest drug on the planet to get off. In fact, it made me suicidal to come off it. That's not quite accurate. I had suicidal feelings, but I also knew it was just the medicine, so I wasn't actually suicidal, if you follow. All I had to do was stave off the days when I felt suicidal, not do anything about it, and know that at some point I would feel better and not want to kill myself anymore. To get off Suboxone, you have to drop a milligram a week until you get to zero. Doing so makes you feel insanely sick for 2 days. Then you get used to the new level, in this case 7 milligrams, and once you stabilize, then you drop again. The suicidal feelings don't start till you get down to 2 milligrams. So, at 2 milligrams, I did probably the most selfish thing I've ever done in my life. I was terrified about how I was going to feel, and I didn't want to go through it alone. Accordingly, I purchased $300 worth of flowers, drove to Laura's house, and begged her to take me back. We sat on her couch in her living room and discussed the ins and outs of what this would mean. Driven completely by fear, I told her I wanted to marry her, possibly even have a child with her. And then something impossible happened. As we were sitting there, I heard a key slowly turning in her front door. And in walked Rome. In walked who now? How is it possible that these two women were standing in the same room? I would give anything to have a time machine, go back to that moment and say, how about a threesome? But this was no time for jokes. My jaw was on the floor. I'm going to go water the plants, Rome said. She headed up the back stairwell and was gone. I think I need to take care of her, Laura said, and left me in the living room. When I realized she wasn't coming back, I took my 2 milligram addiction back to Malibu. It turned out that Rome and Laura had met at an AA meeting, realized who they were, and became fast friends. The bulk of their conversations, as I'm sure you can imagine, were about what an asshole I was. As for me, I couldn't stay in Los Angeles. So, I hopped on a private plane to a Colorado recovery center where they said that they thought they could get me off Suboxone without making me feel suicidal. Well, so much for that idea. I felt suicidal for 36 days in a row, and then flew to New York and appeared on Letterman, trying to hide that I was being held up with tape and paper. Somehow, I pulled it off. 7 years later, after I learned a whole lot about myself, I made real amends to Rome and to Laura, and they both accepted my apology. Believe it or not, the three of us are friends now. Laura is married to a lovely guy named Jordan, and Rome is living with an equally lovely guy named Eric. Recently, the five of us had dinner together at my place, and we all had a lovely time. Then, at around 10 p.m., the two couples left in their respective cars. I heard the engines recede down the canyon toward the city. Out back, as I waited for something to come to me, anything that might make things better, instead, I once again heard the sound of the coyotes. No, it's the sound of me, alone, fending off the demons for one more night. They'd won. And I knew I'd lost as I headed back to my lonely bedroom to fend off those demons and negotiate sleep one more time. Interlude, Violence in Hollywood. I'm not a violent man, but I have been both the victim and the perpetrator of violence one time each in my life. Years ago, right after she quit seeing Justin Timberlake, I got set up on a date with Cameron Diaz. At the time, I was working out a lot and had developed big arms. For the date, I prepared accordingly, taking a long walk with my sleeves rolled up to my shoulders so the guns were appropriately tanned. Pro tip, this helps them look bigger. Yes, I literally tanned my arms for this date. The date was a dinner party with a bunch of other people, but upon seeing me, Cameron got almost instantly stoned. It was clear that she was not interested in me at all. But the party went on, nevertheless, and at one point we were playing a game, Pictionary, I think. As she was drawing, I said something witty to Cameron, to which she said, "Oh, come on," and proceeded to punch me in the shoulder. Or at least that's what she meant to do. But she missed and instead punched me smack in the side of the face. "Are you fucking kidding me?" I said, realizing I'd just been punched in the face by Cameron Diaz and my big arms hadn't helped at all. This was about 15 years ago, but she'll probably call me, don't you think? Then there was this other time. In 2004, I flew out to Chris Evert's Tennis Academy in Florida for a charity event, the Chris Evert Bank of America Pro Celebrity Tennis Classic. It was a veritable who's who in Hollywood, but I was most interested in Chevy Chase. Chevy had long been a hero of mine. In fact, his performance in the movie Fletch had changed my life forever. One chilly night in L.A., my best buddy Matt Andre and I went to see a preview screening of Fletch, and at one point, we were literally rolling in the aisles with laughter. Chevy must have had 300 jokes in that movie, and he landed each one perfectly. Later, as Matt and I sat at the bus stop awaiting our ride home, I vividly remember turning to him and very seriously saying, "Matt, I'm going to talk that way for the rest of my life." And I have. Which makes this next story particularly painful for both Chevy and me. Possibly more for Chevy. Anyway, at the charity ball the night before the tennis event, Chevy walked up to me and said, "I just want you to know I'm a big fan." This was incredible. I said, "Oh my God, all I do is steal from you." And we went on to have a mutually complimentary and quite lovely conversation. Next day, it was time to play tennis. Now, my skills were by this point admittedly rusty. I hadn't played in years, and my ground strokes needed a lot of work. What I did have, though, was an incredibly hard serve. In fact, they had a speed clock at the tournament, and I punched in at 111 miles per hour. The only problem was, I was not exactly sure where they were going, which was fine at your everyday public court, not so fine in front of 2,000 people. Even former President George H.W. Bush was there. The game begins. I am first up to serve. I have my partner in the ad court, and on the opposite side is Chevy, also in the ad court near the net, and his partner back at the baseline to whom I would be serving directly. I toss up the ball, bring my racket around my back, hammer the tennis ball as hard as possible, and watch in horror as instead of it spearing across the court to Chevy's partner, it goes directly straight and it's heading for Chevy Chase. He is standing at the service line, which is exactly 60 feet from where I've hit the ball. This line is, coincidentally, the exact distance from the mound to home plate in baseball. So I can confidently tell you, if the ball was hit at about 100 miles per hour, this means it was traveling at about 146.7 feet per second, meaning Mr. Chase had 0.412 seconds to get out of the way. Mr. Chase did not get out of the way. More precisely, his testicles didn't get out of the way. I have just served something close to a professional speed serve right into his Chevy Chase's, if you know what I mean. Here's what happened next. Chevy made a funny face, just like the one he makes in Fletch when a doctor gives him a prostate exam, and then dropped to the ground. Remember, all of this was going down in front of 2,000 people. Event, now over, it took four medics to dash onto the court, strap him to a gurney, and rush him to the nearest hospital. If this is what I do to my heroes, Michael Keaton and Steve Martin better take cover. And thus concludes the violent section of this audiobook. Chapter 10, The Big Terrible Thing. Imagine this. You have to walk back onto a set where you have almost literally shat the bed for weeks before. You've been out of it, slurring lines, making bad decisions. You're in New York City, and even though you have not one but two sober companions, you call room service at the hotel, your voice shaking, detoxing, and say, "Please put a bottle of vodka in the bathtub in my room." Yes, the bathtub. Hide it in there. And then, when the day is done, you head back to that fucking hotel room, and you drink the bottle of vodka, and you finally feel all right again for maybe 3 hours, and then have to do it all over again the next day. You're shaking, pretending that you are not in very serious trouble whenever you talk to anyone. Using that same shaky voice, you call the hotel and tell them to do the vodka bottle in the bathtub thing again. This is perhaps something that a normie, what we addicts call all you lucky non-alcoholics, might always struggle to understand. I'll have to take a stab at explaining it. When you drink an entire bottle of vodka, you are extremely sick the following day. Having a few drinks in the morning helps, but I was the lead in a giant studio movie, so I could not drink in the morning. You are sick and trembling, and it feels like every part of your insides is trying to squeeze out of your body. And that's all day. The entire 14-hour day. The only way to fix how sick you are is to drink the exact same amount or a little more the following night. "So just don't drink," says the normie. We alcoholics feel like we will literally go insane if we don't drink. Not to mention the alcoholic will be even sicker and look sicker if he doesn't drink the bottle. "But what about the movie?" "Doesn't matter, I have to drink." "How about taking a break for one night?" "Not possible." "Next question?" So, I'm in Dallas, I'm on methadone, a quart of vodka a day, cocaine, and Xanax. Every day I would show up to the set, pass out in my chair, wake up to do a scene, stumble to set, then just basically scream into camera for 2 minutes. Then it was back to my chair for further nap time. At this point in my life, I was one of the most famous people in the world. In fact, I was being burned by the white-hot flame of fame. Therefore, no one dared to say anything about this horrific behavior. The movie people wanted the film to be completed, slap my name on a poster, and make $60 million. And Friends, well, Friends was even worse. No one wanted to mess with that money-making machine. At one point during the filming of Serving Sarah, I thought maybe some Valium would help me somehow. A doctor arrived at my duplex hotel room to give me some. The night before he came to visit, I had drunk a party-sized bottle of vodka, the one with the handle on it. When the doctor looked around the room, he saw the bottle and said in a nervous voice, "Did you drink all of that?" "Yes," I said. "May I have the Valium every 4 hours, not every 6? With that, he turned tail and ran top speed down the spiral staircase and out the door. Presumably so he wouldn't actually be in the room if Matthew Perry died. But away I went to rehab after Jamie Tarsus had told me I was disappearing and eventually came back to finish the movie. This was me during Serving Sarah. I was a mess. I felt so guilty and I apologized to everyone. And I like to think that I did a great job for the final 13 days of shooting. Everyone tried to be kind about it, and they were doing their best, but they were pissed off. The director was pissed off. I'd ruined his movie. Elizabeth Hurley, my co-star, was pissed off. She never got to do another movie either. I needed to make real amends. That's part of what AA teaches you. So I re-recorded my slurred parts for the entire movie, which meant I looped the entire movie. Days and days in a sound studio. 3 beeps in a studio, and I'd say my line to match my mouth. I happened to be good at that, and at the very least, we got the slurring out of the movie. Then I committed to doing the most press possible in the history of press, bending over backward to make things right. I was on the cover of everything, on every talk show you can think of. Of course the movie tanked anyway. I was paid $3.5 million to do the movie, and I got sued for the shutdown. Even though it was a health issue, at the mediation table, a team of insurance flacks faced me down, so I just wrote them a check for $650,000. I remember thinking, man, no one taught me the rules of life. I was a complete mess of a person, selfish and narcissistic. Everything had to be about me. And I matched that with a really handy inferiority complex, an almost fatal combo. I was all about myself from the time I was 10 years old, from the moment when I looked around and said, it's every man for himself. I had to be so focused on me just to keep myself together. But AA will teach you this is no way to live. One of the things you do in the 12 steps of AA is create a personal moral inventory. It's the fourth step. In it, you write down all the people that you're mad at and why. I had 68 names. 68. Then you write down how it affected you, and then you read it to someone. This is step 5. What I learned from this process, and by the care and love of a great sponsor to whom I read my list, was that I wasn't the center of the universe. It's kind of a relief learning that. There were other people around who had needs and cares and were just as important as I was. If you're shaking your head now, go on, have at it. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Sobriety had now become the most important thing in my life, because I learned that if you put anything in front of sobriety, you will lose that anything anyway if you drink. I read my list to my sponsor one beautiful spring day at a wonderful meditation center in Los Angeles called the Self-Realization Fellowship Lake Shrine. Perched on a hill overlooking the Pacific, the place is truly peaceful. There's a lake and gardens and temples and even a pod of some of Mahatma Gandhi's ashes, the only one stashed outside of India. As I finished reading out my list, we realized a wedding was starting in the gardens. I watched as the couple beamed at each other, the families in their best attire, an officiant smiling, waiting to warble on about sickness and health till death do they part. I hadn't been there for anyone for so long, my addiction being my best friend and my evil friend and my punisher and my lover all in one, my big, terrible thing. But that day, up there with the view, there always has to be a view, of course, and with the soon-to-be newlyweds and Gandhi somewhere nearby, I sensed an awakening. That I was here for more than this big, terrible thing. That I could help people, love them. Because of how far down the scale I had gone, I had a story to tell, a story that could really help people. And helping others had become the answer for me. On July 19th, 2019, the front page of the New York Times featured stories about Donald Trump, Stormy Daniels, a deadly arson at a Kyoto animation studio, and Puerto Ricans who, according to the headline, had had enough. I knew none of this, nor would I know anything for the next 2 weeks. Not that El Chapo got life plus 30 years, not that some 19-year-old shot 3 people dead and himself at a garlic festival in Gilroy, California, not that Boris Johnson became the UK Prime Minister. When I awoke from my coma, I was screaming. My mother was there. I asked her what happened. She told me my colon had exploded. "It's amazing that you're alive," she said. "Your resiliency is incredible. And with some life changes, you're going to be okay. And they can remove the colostomy bag in about 9 months." I thought, I have a colostomy bag? That's great. Girls find that to be a definite turn-on. I said, thank you very much. After that, I rolled over and really didn't talk or move for 2 weeks. I had been inches from death because of something that I had done. I was attached to 50 machines, and I would have to learn to walk again. I hated myself. I had almost killed myself. The shame, the loneliness, the regret were too much to handle. I just lay there, trying to deal with all of it, but there was no dealing with it. It had already been done. I was afraid to die, which was in direct opposition to my actions. But it was over. The Matthew Perry Show, canceled by opiates. Sometimes I could pay attention to what was going on in the room, but that was about it. I certainly wasn't taking part in anything. My best friends, Chris and Brian Murray, would come to visit. About 3 weeks into it, Maria, my sister on my father's side, came to see me. "Are you ready to hear what happened?" she said. I nodded. Barely. "After your colon exploded, they put you on a ventilator, which you vomited into. So all of this bile and septic shit went into your lungs. They put you on an ECMO machine. Somehow you survived that, and you were in a coma for 14 days. After that, I don't think I spoke for another week, because I had realized that my greatest fear had come true, which is that I did this to myself. There was one upside, though. A 14-day coma makes it very simple to quit smoking. I had been on opiates and off opiates and back on different opiates for so long, I suffered from a situation that only a subset of the population gets. Opiates cause constipation. It's kind of poetic. I was so full of shit, it almost killed me. Also, I now had a bowel situation. The last thing I said to Aaron before the coma, as I was spinning on the ground in pain, right before I lost consciousness, was, "Don't leave me." I meant right then and there, but she, like the rest of my friends and family, took it literally. Aaron pulled the night shift for 5 months in the hospital. I often look back on that time and am so grateful that this happened before COVID, because then I would have been left alone in that room for 5 months. As it was, I was never alone in that room. That was God's love in human form. Made flesh. Both my mom and I are experts in a crisis now. What I've always wanted to tell her is that little show called Friends, and all the other shows and movies, I essentially did it all for her attention. And yet that's the one person whose attention I did not really get from Friends. She mentioned it on occasion, but she was never boiling with pride about what her son had accomplished. But I don't think there's possibly a way that she could have been proud enough for what I needed. And if you're going to blame your parents for the bad stuff, you also have to give them credit for the good stuff. All the good stuff. I could never have played Chandler if my mother weren't my mother. I would never have made $80 million if my mother weren't my mother. Because Chandler was just a hider of true pain. What better character for a sitcom? To just make a joke about everything so we don't have to talk about anything real. That's how Chandler started. In the initial breakdown of the show, Chandler was supposed to be an observer of other people's lives. So he would be the guy who at the end of the scene would make some joke, comment on whatever just happened. The fool in King Lear, speaking truth where there had been none. But everyone ended up liking Chandler so much that he morphed into being his own major character. That he ended up superseding what I actually did in real life. Getting married, having kids. Well, some things I can't talk about that well. The bottom line is, I abandoned my mother at 15, just as she'd been abandoned by my father. I was not an easy child to put up with, and she was just a child herself. She always did her best and was with me in the hospital for 5 months after the coma. When your colon explodes because of overuse of opiates, the prudent thing to do is not ask for opiates to solve the situation, which is, of course, what I did, and they gave them to me. I was impossibly depressed, and as always, wanted to feel better. Also, the hole in my stomach, the one that you could fit a bowling ball in, was ample excuse to get pain medication. Just so you're following along, I had come within inches of dying because of opiates, and I asked the doctors to solve that problem with opiates. So no, even after the catastrophic event, I was not done. I hadn't learned anything. I still wanted to use. When I got out of the hospital after the explosion, I was actually looking really good. I'd lost a lot of weight, but I was so injured that they couldn't do surgery to replace the bag for at least another 9 months. So I went home to my apartment, lied to everyone about the severity of the pain to get pain medication. I was not actually in pain. It was more an annoyance than pain. But doctors believed the lie and gave me tons of opiates. And obviously, I started smoking again. And that was kind of my life. And let's not forget, the colostomy bag was constantly breaking, regularly, 50 times at least, leaving me with shit all over me. Dear colostomy bag people, make a bag that doesn't break, you fucking morons. Did I make you laugh on Friends? If so, don't put shit all over my face. When an addict takes a pill, they feel euphoric. But after a short while, the pill doesn't make them euphoric anymore because a tolerance is built up. But the addict still really, really wants to feel euphoric again, so they take two instead to get the feeling that one originally gave them. Then two is not enough, and they go to three. In the past, I had played that little game until the number got up to 55 pills a day. Just watched the second half of season 3 of Friends. I was so frail and skinny and sick. It definitely showed. But no one said anything about it. The UCLA hospital was giving me opiates for my fake stomach pain, but I needed more. So I called a drug dealer. But I was on the 40th floor of that building in Century City, and that meant I had to figure out a way to go down 40 floors, give the dealer the money in an empty cigarette pack, and get my pills. Then I had to get back to the 40th floor unnoticed, take the pills, and I would get to feel good for a while. Now, I had to do this with a sober companion, a nurse, and Aaron all living in the apartment. Turns out, I was terrible at it. I tried 4 times and got caught exactly 4 times. The UCLA doctors were not pleased with this and said I had to go to rehab. I had no choice. I was addicted to everything they gave me. Had I just said no, fuck off, it might have been a glorious moment, but then the drugs would stop, and I would get crazy sick. I was put in a rather strange position of choosing where I'd be locked up for months, given the choice of New York or Houston. Maybe somebody more capable than me should be given that decision. I, being the least qualified to make any decisions, picked New York. I was high as a kite and fakely clutching my stomach when we arrived at the recovery center in New York. Even though the place resembled a prison, the people in there were all smiles. "The fuck are you guys so happy about?" I said. I had a tendency to be a bit grumpy. I was on 14 milligrams of Ativan and 60 milligrams of OxyContin. I had a colostomy bag. I asked where I could smoke and was told there would be no smoking here. "Well, I can't stay here if I can't smoke," I said. "Well, you can't smoke here." "Yeah, I heard what you said. How in the world am I supposed to quit smoking on top of everything else?" "We'll give you a patch." "Don't blame me if I smoke the actual fucking patch," I said. It was agreed that they would keep me on the Ativan, put me on Suboxone, and I could smoke during the detox, but not when I was on the main unit. This meant that I could smoke for 4 more days. When I wanted to smoke, the staff member would escort me outside and stand next to me while I puffed away. That was relaxing. Three nights went by, and then I met a very pretty, extremely smart nurse. She took very good care of me, and I flirted with her as much as you can flirt with someone who is changing your colostomy bag on the reg. The dreaded day where I would have to quit smoking was looming. So I was allowed to walk out with the wonderful nurse to get coffee. Accordingly, my mood lifted a bit. I made jokes. I flirted in that we're all in rehab, so nothing can really happen way, as we returned. Back at the center, the nurse said, "I need you to do something for me." "Whatever you need," I said. "I need you to stop trying to fuck the hot nurse." She was referring to herself. "Jesus. I thought we were both flirting in a safe, never gonna happen kind of way," I said. I was there for 4 more months. I never flirted with her again. Nor did she flirt back at my non-flirting. Perhaps because she'd seen me covered in my own shit multiple times. I moved up to the unit, met therapist Bruce, Wendy, whatever, whom I wanted nothing to do with. All I wanted to do was smoke, or talk about smoking, or smoke while talking about smoking. Everyone just looked like a giant cigarette. I rarely left my room. The bag kept breaking. I called my mother and asked her to come save me. She said that I would smoke if I left, and that would be awful for the upcoming surgery. I called my therapist, begged her to get me out. She said the same thing my mom had. I was fucked and stuck. Panic set in. My bag was full. I was not high. There was nothing separating me from me. I felt like a little kid scared of monsters in the dark. But was I the monster? I found the stairwell. The nurse? Nowhere to be found. Therapy? Fuck therapy. I hit those walls with my head just as hard as Jimmy Connors used to hit his forehands down the line. Lots of topspin. Right on the fucking line. Stairwells. I'm this close to dying every day. I don't have another sobriety in me. If I went out, I would never be able to come back. And if I went out, I would go hard. I would have to go hard because my tolerance is so high. It's not like the Amy Winehouse story where she was sober for a while and then the first drink she had killed her. She said something in that documentary that is true for me too. She had just won a Grammy and she said to a friend, "I can't enjoy this unless I'm drunk." The idea of being famous, the idea of being rich, the idea of being me, I can't enjoy any of it unless I'm high. And I can't think of love without wanting to be high. I lack a spiritual connection that protects me from these feelings. That's why I'm a seeker. The first time I reached 55 pills a day, like the character Betsy Malum in Dope Sick, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know that I was addicted. I'm one of the first famous people who went to rehab and people knew about it. In 1997, I was on the #1 TV show in America, and I went to rehab, and it was on the cover of all the magazines. But I had no idea what was happening to me. Betsy Malum in Dope Sick graduates to heroin and it's sayonara. You see her just kind of nod out, smile, and die. But that smile is the feeling that I wanted all the time. She must have felt so good, but it killed her. But that beatific moment is something I still seek, only without the death part. I want a connection. I want that connection to something bigger than me because I'm convinced it's the only thing that will truly save my life. I don't want to die. I'm scared to die. I'm not even good at finding the drugs. Somebody at one point that I worked with introduced me to a crooked doctor. I would claim that I had migraine headaches, actually. I had maybe 8 doctors going for my made-up migraines. And I would still sit through a 45-minute MRI to get drugs. Sometimes, when things were really bad, I'd go to a drug dealer's house. The nurse of the doctor took over from him when he died. She had all the pills, and she lived in the valley, and whenever I wanted to get pills, I would go see her. I'd be terrified the entire time. She'd say, "Come in." "No," I shouted. "We're going to get arrested. Just take the money and let me get out of here." Later, she wanted me to sit down and do coke with her. I'd get the pills, and because I was so terrified, I'd take 3 instantly and drive home and be high to take the edge off the fear, which just meant I was even more arrestable. Much later, when I lived in Century City, I'd try to find excuses to go down 40 stories to score. I was so sick and so injured at the time, my stomach hadn't closed yet. I was alone during COVID. I had a nurse on staff giving me drugs, but I wasn't getting high from them anymore. So I would call a drug dealer and get more oxy. This way, I'd have additional drugs to the ones I'd been prescribed, so that I could actually feel them. The street pills were something like $75 per pill, so I was giving the guy $3,000 at a time, many times a week. But I got caught more times than I was able to pull it off. The UCLA doctor in charge of my case got fed up with me and told me he wouldn't help me anymore. I couldn't really blame him. Everybody was terrified about fentanyl being in the pills and me dying from them. When I got to the treatment center, sure enough, I tested positive for fentanyl. This disease, the big horrible thing, addiction, has ruined so much of my life it isn't funny. It ruined relationships. It ruined the day-to-day process of being me. I have a friend who doesn't have any money, lives in a rent-controlled apartment, never made it as an actor, has diabetes, is constantly worried about money, doesn't work, and I would trade places with him in a second. In fact, I would give up all the money, all the fame, all the stuff to live in a rent-controlled apartment. I trade being worried about money all the time to not have this disease, this addiction. And not only do I have the disease, but I also have it bad. I have it as bad as you can have it. In fact, it's backs to the wall time all the time. It's gonna kill me. I guess something has to. Robert Downey Jr., talking about his addiction, once said, "It's like having a gun in my mouth with my finger on the trigger, and I like the taste of the metal." I got it. I understood that. Even on good days, when I'm sober and I'm looking forward, it's still with me all the time. There's still a gun. Fortunately, I guess, there's not enough opiates in the world to make me high anymore. I have a very, very, very low bottom. Things have to get truly awful. They have to get big and terrible before I quit anything. When I was doing the show Mr. Sunshine, I was basically running it, writing it, starring in it. Then at home, I was working on notes for a writer on a script that he had written. I had a bottle of vodka next to me. I made myself 13, 14 drinks. But homemade drinks, so triples. After about the 14th drink, I wasn't drunk anymore. So I quit drinking. I think I'm now at the point with opiates where it's the same situation. There just isn't enough. I took 1,800 milligrams of opiates in Switzerland per day, and it wasn't enough. So what am I going to do? Call a drug dealer and ask for all the drugs? Now, when I think of an OxyContin, my mind flashes directly to having a colostomy bag for life, which is something I could not handle. That's why I think it'll be pretty easy for me to continue being off opiates. They don't work anymore. And I could wake up from another surgery, there have already been 14 since the first one, with an irreversible colostomy bag. It's time to figure something else out. As said, the next level is heroin, and I won't go there. Me quitting drinking and opiates doesn't have anything to do with strength, by the way. It just doesn't work anymore. If somebody came into my house right now and said, "Here's 100 milligrams of oxy," I'd say, "It's not enough." The problem remains, though. I'm there wherever I go. I bring along the problems and the darkness and the shit, so every time I leave a rehab, I do a geographic and buy a new fucking house. And then I live in it. And the first thing I used to do when I looked at houses, which is a hobby of mine, was go through the homeowner's medicine cabinets to see if they had any pills I could purloin. You can't be a dick about it, though. You have to take the right amount. You can't take too many or they'll know for sure. So you check the date on the pill bottle. You want something that's sort of out of date. If it's been a long time out of date, you can take a bunch of them. But if it's brand new, you could only take a couple. I would hit 5 open houses on a Sunday. That'd be my whole day. At one point, when I was taking 55 pills a day, I would wake up and somehow have to find those 55 pills. It was like a full-time job. My whole life was math. I need 8 to get home. Then I'll be there for 3 hours, so I need 4 more. And then I have to go to a dinner party, so I need 7 for that. And all this just to maintain, to not be sick, to avoid the inevitable, which is detox. I imagine those homeowners arriving back after their open house and eventually at some point opening their medicine cabinet. Is it possible that Chandler? No, not Chandler. Surely not Chandler Bing. Now, instead of open houses, I'm having one built. I started the process because about 18 months ago, I couldn't complete a sentence. Things got so flat, so awful for me. Doctors came in. My mother came in. Everybody came in and took care of me because I couldn't talk. I was so out of it. I had to do something. I had that $20 million penthouse apartment in Century City where I was doing drugs and watching TV and having sex with my girlfriend of a few months. One night, I passed out and she was passed out, and when we woke up, my mother and Keith Morrison were at the foot of my bed. I thought, am I in an episode of Dateline? And if I am, why is my mother also in it? My mother looked at my girlfriend and said, I think it's time for you to leave. This saved my life. My dad has saved my life multiple times, too. When he helped me get to Marina Del Rey after Jamie Tarsus had told me I was disappearing before her eyes, I was deathly afraid that I would never have fun again for the rest of my life. After about 3 weeks, I called Marta Kaufman and David Crane to tell them I was sober and could return to friends. When are you coming back? They said. We need you to come back. It's going to be very work intensive. We have to start in 2 weeks, or we won't be able to do it. But I was still very sick. My father had overheard the tenor of the conversation and called Marta and David back. I will pull him off your television show, Dad said, if you continue to act this way around him. I was so grateful for him, for being my dad and doing the dad thing. But I also didn't want to be the problem. They were just doing their job. They had the number one hit TV show, and 2 of the main characters were about to get married. I couldn't just disappear. I just wanted everything to be okay. So then I moved from Marina Del Rey to Promises in Malibu and was told I was going to need more than 28 days. I would need months to get better from this. 2 weeks later, I was driven to the set of Friends by a technician from Malibu. When I arrived, Jen Aniston said, I've been mad at you. Honey, I said, if you knew what I'd been through, you would not be mad at me. With that, we hugged, and I got the work done. I married Monica and got driven back to the treatment center. At the height of my highest point in Friends, the highest point in my career, the iconic moment on the iconic show, in a pickup truck helmed by a sober technician. Not all the lights were green on Sunset that night, let me tell you. I can't be useful in a relationship because I'm both trying to hang on and in so much fear that I'll be left. And that fear is not even real. Because in my 53 years, and with all the wonderful girls I've had, I've only been left once, many years back. You would think this would be outweighed by all the others I left. Yet she was everything to me. The smart man in me sees it clearly, though. She was only 25, just trying to have a good time. We dated for a few months, but I let all my walls down. I decided once and for all to just be myself. And then she dumped me. She had never promised me anything. I was drinking like a maniac, too. And I don't blame her. I had to see her at a play reading a couple of years ago. She played my wife. "How are you?" she said before the reading. And I pretended I was fine, but I was in hell. "Get out of there. Do not engage," I thought. "Just pretend everything's okay." "I have a couple of kids with my partner now," she said. "And life is good. Are you with anybody?" "No," I said. "I'm still looking." I wish I wouldn't have said that because it made it sound like I was still looking ever since she dumped me. But it's true. I'm still looking. Then the play reading ended and she was no longer my wife and I got the hell out of there. And she still looked exactly the same. These days, I have faith in God. But too often, that faith seems, well, blocked. But then everything is blocked by the medication I'm on. These days, too, I ask this question. Am I blocking my relationship with a higher power by taking Suboxone? One of my big problems and the reason I've had so much trouble getting sober over the years is I never let myself feel uncomfortable long enough to have a spiritual connection. So I fix it with pills and alcohol before God can jump in and fix me. I did a breathwork class recently. For a half an hour, you breathe in this very intense, very uncomfortable way. You cry, you see things, you kind of feel high. For me, it's a freebie high, the best kind. But the Suboxone even blocks that feeling. Half the doctors I speak to say I should be on Suboxone for at least a year, but probably the rest of my life. Other doctors tell me I'm not technically sober while I'm still on it. It's very difficult to get all the way off in either way, which is ironic because it's a drug used to get you off other drugs. Recently, when I was hooked up to an IV of it, the dosage I was receiving was 0.5 lower than it was supposed to be, and it got me so sick and scared I had to bump it back up. You feel terrible when you stop taking it. When you take heroin, the drugs hit your opiate receptors, and then you are high, and then it fades, and you're not hitting the opiate receptors anymore. Then you're sober for a while. Then, maybe the next day, you hit your opiate receptors again, and then you're high, and on. But Suboxone works differently, wrapping itself around the receptor, and it doesn't go away, which means it's basically damaging your receptors 24/7. So one of the theories that I have about my struggle with happiness is that I've damaged these receptors. My dopamine gets replaced by the Suboxone. The dopamine hit is what you get when you enjoy something, like looking at a sunset or playing tennis, and you make a good shot or you hear a song you love. But I'm pretty sure my opiate receptors are very seriously damaged, possibly to the point of no return. That's why I'm always a little bummed. Just like pancreatitis, maybe if I'd left my opioid receptors alone for an extended period, they'd fix themselves and I'd be happy again. I've seen God in my kitchen, of all places. So I know there's something bigger than me. I know I can't make a plant, for a start. I know it's an omnipresent love and acceptance that means that everything's going to be okay. I know that something happens when you die. I know you move on to something wonderful. Alcoholics and addicts like myself want to drink for the sole purpose of feeling better. Well, that's at least true for me. All I ever wanted was to feel better. I didn't feel good. I had to have a couple of drinks and I felt better. But as the disease progresses, it takes more and more and more and more and more and more and more to feel better. If you puncture the membrane of sobriety, alcoholism kicks in and goes, "Hey, remember me? Nice to see you again. Now, give me just as much as you did last time, or I'll kill you or make you crazy." And then the obsession of my mind kicks in. I can't stop thinking about feeling better, matched with the phenomenon of craving, and what you're left with is a bruise that starts off one way and never gets better. Nobody has a drinking problem and then stops and then drinks socially and it's fine. The disease just picks up. The Big Book says that alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. But I would also add that it's patient. As soon as you raise your hand and say, "I'm having a problem," it's as though addiction says, "Well, if you're going to be stupid and say something about it, I'll go away for a while. I'll be in rehab for 3 months and think, well, I'm going to use when I get out of here, but I can wait for 9 more days to do it." The disease is just drumming its fingers. In AA, it's often said that when you're in a meeting, your disease is doing one-arm push-ups outside, just waiting for you to leave. I've almost died several times, and the lower you get down the scale, death is as low as it goes, FYI, the more people you can help. So when my life is firing on all cylinders, I have folks I sponsor, people calling me to help them with their lives. The 2 years from 2001 to 2003 were two of the happiest of my life. I was helping people, sober, strong. There were other good side effects of sobriety. I was also single for some of it. So I'd go to clubs, but I didn't want to drink. The miracle had happened for me. And let me tell you, no one is more popular at 2 a.m. in a club than a sober guy who says, "Hi, how are you?" to a woman. I don't think I've ever gotten laid more than those 2 years. But the disease is patient. You slowly stop going to all the meetings you're supposed to go to. I don't really need to go to the one on Friday night. And then, by the time you're deep into that kind of thinking, alcoholism is coming for you, baffling and powerful and patient. Suddenly, you're not going to any meetings anymore, and you've convinced yourself that you understand it all. Now, I don't need to do this anymore. I get it. Addicts are not bad people. We're just people who are trying to feel better, but we have this disease. When I feel bad, I think, give me something that makes me feel better. It's as simple as that. I would still love to drink and take drugs, but because of the consequences, I don't. Because I'm so late stage that it would kill me. Recently, my mother told me that she was proud of me. I'd written a movie and she'd read it. I'd wanted her to say that my whole life. When I pointed this out, she said, "What about a little forgiveness?" "I do forgive you," I said. "I do." I wonder if she can forgive me for everything I've put her through. If a selfish, lazy fuck like myself can change, then anyone can. No secret gets worse just because it has been told. At this point in my life, the words of gratitude pour out of me because I should be dead. And yet somehow I'm not. There must be a reason for that. It's simply too hard for me to understand if there isn't. I don't believe in half-assing things anymore. The path of least resistance is boring, and scars are interesting. They tell an honest story, and they are proof that a battle was fought, and in my case, a hard one. I have many scars now. The first time I took my shirt off in the bathroom after returning from the hospital after my first surgery, I burst into tears. I was so disturbed by it. I thought life was over. After about a half an hour, I got my shit together enough to call my drug dealer, who proceeded to ask me what was wrong, like he was a social worker or a priest, not a drug dealer. 3 days ago, I had my 14th surgery. It's 4 years later. I cried again. I should learn to get used to it, though, because there will be more surgeries. I will never be done. I will always have the bowels of a man in his 90s. In fact, I have never not cried after a surgery. Not once. I've stopped calling the drug dealers, though. There are so many scars on my stomach that all I need to do is look down to know that I've been through a war, a self-inflicted war. Once, at some Hollywood function, shirts allowed, nay, insisted on. In fact, thank God, Martin Sheen turned to me and said, "Do you know what St. Peter says to everyone who tries to get into heaven?" When I looked blankly, the man who once was president said, "Peter says, don't you have any scars?" And when most would respond proudly, "Well, no, I don't," Peter says, "Why not? Was there nothing worth fighting for?" Martin Sheen, like Pacino, Sean Penn, Ellen DeGeneres, Kevin Bacon, Chevy Chase, Robert De Niro, these are all members of the famous club I've encountered. An informal little thing you join when you're in an airport or at a function and someone also famous comes up and says hi, like we know each other. The scars, though. The scars. My stomach looks like a topographical map of China. And they fucking hurt. Sadly, these days, my body just laughs at 30 milligrams of OxyContin. Oral meds don't work at all. The only thing that works a little bit is IV medication. And obviously I can't take that at home, so off I go, back to the hospital. In January 2022, I'd had a 6-inch incision with metal staples. This is the life of someone who's been blessed with the big, terrible thing. And they aren't letting me smoke. It'll be a good day if I get through it not smoking and nothing crazy happens. When I don't smoke, I gain weight, too. In fact, recently I gained so much weight that when I looked into a mirror, I thought someone was following me. When you get sober, you gain weight. When you quit smoking, you gain weight. Those are the rules. As for me, I would trade places with each and every one of my friends, Pressman, Bierko, any of them, because none of them had a big, terrible thing to deal with. None of them had battled their entire lives with a brain that was built to kill them. I would give it all up to not have that. No one believes this, but it's true. My life is no longer on fire, though. Dare I say it, throughout all this turmoil, I have grown up. I am more real, more genuine. I don't need to leave the people in a room screaming in laughter. I just need to stand up straight and leave the room. And hopefully not walk directly into a closet. It's a calmer me now, a more genuine me, a more capable me. Sure, there is a chance that if I want a good role in a movie, I'd have to write it now. But I can do that too. I am enough. I'm more than enough. And I don't need to put on a show anymore. I have made my mark. Now it's time to sit back and enjoy it and find true love and real life, not one that is run on fear. I am me, and that should be enough, and it always has been enough. I was the one who didn't get that, and now I do. I'm an actor. I'm a writer. I'm a person. And a good one at that. I want good things for myself and others. And I continue to work for these things. There is a reason I'm still here. And figuring out why is the task that has been put in front of me. And it will be revealed. There is no rush, no desperation. Just the fact that I'm here and I care about people is the answer. Now, when I wake up, I wake up curious, wondering what the world has in store for me, and I for it. And that's enough to go on. I want to keep learning. I want to keep teaching. Those are the grand hopes I have for myself. But in the meantime, I want to laugh and have a good time with my friends. I want to make love to a woman I am madly in love with. I want to become a father and make my mother and my father proud. I love art now, too, and I've started collecting. I got my Banksy painting at an auction in New York. I bought it via the phone. I've never met him, but I want him to know if there was ever a fire, my Banksy would be the first thing I'd save. I wonder if he'd care. Actually, he'd probably set fire to it himself. I've accomplished a lot in my life, but there is still so much left to do, which daily excites me. I was a kid from Canada who had all his dreams come true. They were just the wrong dreams. And instead of giving up, I changed and found new dreams. I keep finding them all the time. They're right there in the view, in the valley, on the edging and flashes that bounce off the ocean when the sun hits just so. When someone does something nice for someone, I see God. But you can't give away something you don't have, so I try to improve myself daily. When those moments come and I am needed, I've worked out my shit, and I do what we're all here for, which is simply to help other people.